Hey everybody, I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Hey everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond podcast, and as always, we bring to you guests that have information, insight, and wisdom, as well as lived experience. And before we get into introducing our guests this week, I want to give a quick shout out and a heartfelt shout out to sponsors this week of our podcast. We have Dragonfly Mary, we have Mindful Mark Grusbeck, and also Meg Smith. And I want to give a heartfelt shout out to all of their support. And again, people can go and support the PTSD and Beyond podcast on drdeblind.com and look at our Patreon page as well as our Ko-fi, and any purchase that you have directly goes right back into supporting our chat as well as our weekly podcast. So getting into the podcast guest, right? It's always a pleasure to bring people on who can share their lived experiences where somebody out there today might be saying, you know what? All of these podcasts have been really great. And my experience as a firefighter, my experience as a first line supporter, a person who is out in the trenches, out in the field, might be saying to themselves, you know what? I would really like to hear from somebody in addition to, say, Tim Gracious. Maybe there's somebody else whose story resonates with me. Maybe there's somebody out there that's going to share some information about EMDR and addictions and talk about things that are generally not really covered in fire service as well as with first responders. So maybe somebody who's an EMT, police officer. So if you are one of those people, or you're somebody who supports and loves an individual who's in fire service, again, a first line responder, take note and listen up, because today's guest, you guys, is a person who brings experience, that's lived experience, with post-traumatic stress, with understanding what it's like to have daily challenges, and as well as overcoming those things. Today's guest, you guys, is a battalion chief at a rural metro fire department in Arizona. He brings decades of experience with helping peers as well as himself. Folks, let's give a PTSD and Beyond heartfelt welcome to Christopher Diver.
Hi, Deb. Thanks for having me. That was a great introduction.
Well, as always, you know, like I said, people who are willing to be on our show and be guests, they're always folks that have lived experiences that want to share and that are just givers in general and really wanting to make a difference. And one of the things I'd like us to cover, and we talked a little bit about this before starting the podcast, is your story, how you got to where you're at. You were in retirement. Now you've come out of retirement, and the ways that you're supporting peers. So share with people a little bit about who is Christopher and your life story.
Oh, sure. So I guess first and foremost with the topic and the title of your podcast, I am a survivor of suicide. My father completed suicide in 1977 when I was 5 years old. I was with my mom when we found him, and I have been told by a therapist that that date was the end of my childhood, and I just really, it screwed up my head. I guess throughout most of my young adult life, I was experiencing a lot of issues, anger management, unable to forget the terrible things that first responders see in their everyday life. News events became incredibly hard for me to watch and absorb, or I guess I absorbed it too much and was just not able to let it go. Was working in the fire department in Northern New Jersey, September 11, 2001. So millions of people witnessed it on television. I happened to witness it with my own eyes. You could see the Twin Towers from the fire station in New Jersey that I worked at. So just a myriad of sentinel events in my life that I was unable to really cope with and forget about. And I guess early in my 30s was diagnosed actually with PTSD, depression and anxiety, and began really seeking treatment for it, but in a way that I was just connecting the dots, so to speak. Yes, I'm going to therapy. Yes, we're talking about this. I'm getting much better. And I really wasn't. It wasn't until I retired from the fire department in New Jersey in 2017 and moved out to Arizona that my, because I was retired and no longer working, I had nothing to get up in the morning for. So I became a, what I term as a functional alcoholic. I was a functional alcoholic before that, but just never really came to grips with it, in my own mind. And, you know, they say the first step in recovery is admitting to yourself that you have a problem. And that was a very difficult thing to do. And then I found a therapist out here in Arizona. She is a first responder as well, so she knows exactly where I'm coming from. And we began doing EMDR about a year and a half ago, and it's just it's life altering. I don't really know how else to describe it, but it is the best thing I've ever done for my behavioral health, and at the same time, it's the worst thing that I've ever done because it's so difficult, and it really forces you as the patient to face those demons, so to speak. Right. You know, and any therapy that you sit there and talk to somebody, you are somewhat facing the demons, but I think EMDR really brings those things that are in the dark reaches of your mind out into the light where they don't like to be.
I agree with that, Chris. I have experienced EMDR with my therapist as well. And I will completely agree. I mean, I am resonating with everything that you're saying with, and folks, if you're wondering what EMDR is, I'll post some information in the summary about what EMDR is, and then also the link to the National Association. But yes, EMDR is really difficult, and it can be extremely difficult for people who are maybe not ready to do the work. So one of the things you touched on is that we first need to admit to ourselves that we have a problem. We first need to admit to ourselves that there is a problem. Maybe we mm-hmm. ourselves are not a problem, but that we have a problem.
Right.
And that admittance to self is so important in order to, I want to say, jump in and do the work and be 110% in. But what I want to ask you is what was the moment that got you to that point? Because in our session right now, we're talking about, it's so key because even right now, this month is Suicide Prevention Month. And people mm-hmm. are asking the question right now, Chris, that are watching their loved ones. And this resonates really well with my heart right now, especially in our family, is mm-hmm. do people need to hit a rock bottom point, or mm-hmm. can they, it's not in either or, but can they reach a admission awareness moment before hitting rock bottom, or do they have to hit rock bottom? What was your awareness moment?
I guess I think the rock bottom moment is necessary for some people. Like you hear a lot of stories with people, especially that are going through AA, that you know, they had a DUI or they were involved in a serious motor vehicle accident while under the influence, and that was their aha moment, so to speak, that they realized that I am no longer in control of what is happening to me. The bottle, the pill bottle, the drugs, whatever it is controlling me. Does everybody have to hit that rock bottom? Probably not. I did. October 15th of 2015, I was working as a paramedic in New Jersey, and my partner and I responded to a call. You know, like hindsight bias being what it is, everything about the scene said, you know, don't enter the scene. It didn't look safe, but somebody was yelling for help. We went and did our jobs, and someone who was having a behavioral health crisis himself pointed a gun at my partner and I. And like I said, I've witnessed a lot of catastrophic things in my career, but that for some reason was my tipping point. I think that my amygdala got overloaded at that point, and that was it. I went home and I drank real heavily that night, and the next few nights I started having panic attacks. The gentleman that was having the crisis had brown hair and a brown goatee. The next day I was in Lowe's and saw a guy with brown hair and a brown goatee, and I had a panic attack in one of the aisles of Lowe's. And it was an earth shattering experience for me. So that was the tipping point when I think I realized that my behavioral health was now having not only, it always had manifestations in the anger, but you know, that outwardly now I'm having physical, emotional reactions to it. If I'm verbalizing that properly. And that was when I realized that I needed to start doing more work with a therapist, geared towards not just talking about all the crap that happens in my life, but just really focusing on the post-traumatic stress disorder of my behavioral health, that aspect of it. And I never really, I always blew off that. Yeah, I know my dad died when I was 5. Yeah, I was there and witnessed it, blah, blah, blah. But I never attributed that to how it controlled me moving forward as a grown man. And it's sad that it did. And it took me so long to realize it, but it's at the same time, it's fascinating to me from a, an educational standpoint of how something that so sentinel could happen to you as such a young person, that it really controls everything that happened in my life for literally the next 40 years.
You know, that is a real profound thing to say, because one of the things that I have found working with people, as well as listening to other people's stories, is that there are people who will say, well, that just happened in my past, or I was really little when that happened. So if we talk about, like, you know, pre-verbal trauma, or, you know, witnessing things as a little kid, say such as abandonment from a parent, for example, maybe somebody, you know, says, I never knew that person really. Those experiences can shape an individual, and then also come out in other ways of control when we are adults. That is so very true. So yeah. You mentioned something earlier today too, before we started recording here for the podcast, is that the thought of, you know, you are enough. So when we move from this awareness and this education piece, how does, with the education piece and getting yourself help and you know, becoming where we are each day, how did you accept and embrace the thought of, you know what, I am enough?
That came actually from when I came out here and I started seeing my therapist, Dana, out here in Arizona. She also did a intensive outpatient program, basically group therapy for just first responders out here in the Valley. And she asked me to go to it a couple times, and I was like, no, that's not for me. You know, letting my machismo and my masculinity, my ego control me. And basically that was just my system of denial. So I finally went to the group therapy, and my anxiety and my depression were really, really triggered. I was like 11 or 12 out of the 0 to 10 scale that morning. And then I sat there and, like, I was just trying to fold myself into the cushions of the chair. Like, I was just so uncomfortable, didn't want to be there. And they opened up talking with a guy who'd been in the group before, a law enforcement officer out here. And he started to tell a story, and he began to cry. And that was another one of my aha moments, that this is exactly what I need. I don't need to just sit across the table or across the desk from someone who has a couple of initials after their name and has read the DSM-5 manual. I really need to listen and learn and talk to people who have actually been down that path that I have been on. And that was incredibly, incredibly helpful to me. And I decided that, you know, everything that happened in my life, there was nobody else that was going to help me as much as I could help myself. And I needed to realize that I needed to be my own advocate for my behavioral health.
Yes.
I needed to realize that the problems were bigger than me. So I went and I spoke to my physician about it. I started taking an antidepressant, which I was always adamantly against that. But I've been on an antidepressant for almost 3 years now, and it significantly has helped me. Talking with my therapist once a week and doing EMDR has helped me. So I decided that I wanted to get a tattoo, and it's on the inside of my left wrist. So I just turn my hand over and I can read it every day or whenever I'm having any kind of an issue. And then anytime that I'm, you know, using my left hand, it's in my eyes almost all the time. And it's just a very subtle and daily reminder that everybody else external to me can help me and will help me, but I need to help myself and make that conscious decision that I will be better today than I was yesterday, and tomorrow will be a better day for me as well. And that's what I have to do. That's my daily mantra, and that's what basically keeps me alive.
I love this. I love it. Can I ask, what does the tattoo say? Are you willing to share? Is it a picture?
Yeah,
or
all it says is I am enough, and underneath of it is a semicolon. Tattooed semicolon.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's all it is. Yep.
You know, what's really interesting about this conversation is, you know, when you talk about things like, no one can help me better than I can help myself. And there are daily reminders. So this is stuff that we do every single day. And I think that one of the things that some people think about is that, well, I can do some of this and then I can set it aside. And what I would hope that people are getting out of our conversation today, Chris, is that it's really not work that we do every day. It's something that happens naturally. And when we have a tipping point, that is like the catalyst to awakening. And then after that, there are several aha moments that happen. Mm-hmm. They can be affirming that, yes, you know what, this is the path, this is the direction. And it can also be an aha moment of, you know what, I don't want to go down there. That is something that I'm going to say I'm going to pass on. Maybe right. It's relationships or friends or job or situation or food. It is whatever resonates with that person. And then, you know, you have a daily reminder that is a tattoo. And in the moment that you need it, it's right there to say, hey, you know what, I am enough. And then the semicolon is very symbolic. I have been wanting to get something in the same area also. And now with COVID, that's really impossible to do that. Right. But as soon as COVID is over, I have something too that I'd like to get as a daily reminder. So right now I wear a silicone bracelet that has this on there, but okay. I can completely resonate with what you're saying. And I know that other people that are listening are thinking, yeah, but this is great. And yes, I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. How do I get myself to be there? So how did you overcome obstacles? And when you overcome obstacles, how did you decide then, you know, I'm going to take this, I'm going to be an advocate?
I think one of the first steps that I took was Dana was the second therapist that I saw out here. So I found one, went through the EAP program, found a therapist out here, went and saw her. So the first introductory meeting, told her my whole backstory, and she was taking notes, and then met a week later and had some more conversation. And at the end of it, she put the notebook down and said, well, Chris, I think that you have post-traumatic stress disorder. And I just kind of looked at her and said, well, yeah, no kidding. I told you that the other day. And that was eye-opening for me in that I needed to find somebody else. So I fired that therapist, never made another appointment with her. And that was a bellwether moment for me, because I was taking control of it and saying, I need more than what this woman obviously is able to offer me. Right. So that's how I finally just researched for a therapist that was a trauma specialist. So for the listeners out there, if you have past traumas in your life, physical, emotional, psychological, whatever they may be, it would behoove you to find a behavioral health professional that specializes in treating that type of a trauma. just as similar if you have, alcoholism or an eating disorder, whatever, you don't want to just go to a generic run-of-the-mill PhD person that they may not specialize in what exactly it is that you're suffering from. Similar if you're, if you have a broken bone, you're not just going to go to your general practitioner. He or she's not going to be able to fix that. You have to go to the specialist. When you're talking about the stuff that goes on in your brain, you have to see a specialist that specializes in whatever it is that your complaint is, because they can help you the best. And I can't say how much I thank Dana every time I see her, and she says, it's you who are taking this journey. I just showed you where the path was, but I know, I am alive today because of Dana. And I say that unequivocally, and I say it with my wife sitting in front of me, because it's the absolute truth. My wife said to me one day, isn't my love enough to keep you from hurting yourself? And I said, do you think my father didn't love me? I do think my father loved me. I think my father had multiple sclerosis, and in the 60s and 70s, there was really no treatment for it. And he was just in a bad place. And unfortunately my mother was not ready, willing, and able to care for him. And he ended his pain. I think a lot of what people maybe that don't have a lot of history in behavioral health, especially the keyboard cowboys on social media, think that, suicide is a cop out. And what suicide is just, it's just somebody's pain is overwhelming. And that's the only way that they see that pain stops is by ending their life. And it's terrible. And the ripple effects of suicide are, well researched, but it's, people say that it's selfish, and it's not. It's not selfish at all, that the person just can't get the help that they need.
You know what? This really touches on something that many listeners, I'm sure, want to hear and that need to hear. There's a lot of discussion. I agree with what you're saying about, especially on social media, and some of the horrific comments to suicide survivors, suicide ideation, the lack of understanding. And frankly, it's not that the information isn't out there for mm-hmm. somebody to say that, well, I didn't know. We don't have a card catalog anymore. We don't live in a society, in a world where we're limited to going to the library and we got to pull out the wooden box and thumb through the, I'm dating myself, right?
Yes, you are. I know what you're talking about.
Thumb through the files, right? No, all you got to do is sit down at any computer, bring out your smartphone, and the plethora of information is there. Everything from peer-reviewed journal articles to things from the NIA, National Institute of Health. There's well-respected institutions like the Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins. So to say that somebody didn't know, I don't personally believe and professionally believe that the education component is where we're lacking. It's a values-based bias, and it's taught a mindset. And you're right. When people talk about suicide ideation, as well as, reasons why people have thought about it or did it, and they're survivors, is because right. the pain got so great, they wanted the pain to just stop.
Yes.
And what's interesting about the direction of our conversation right now is that mm-hmm. people, spouses and family members, are saying, why am I not enough? Why am I not enough for you to change? Why am I not enough for the help? I felt the same with my dad. I can remember having that conversation with my dad and saying, and feeling like, why am I not enough for him to make that change? And with my dad too, it was about the pain.
Yes.
It was about the pain and wanting the pain to stop. Mm-hmm. And what we can do is provide support, and that support can look different. And sometimes we also, as part of the support and part of the love, is to say to someone, okay, I'm going to stop doing these things, because at some point you need to take responsibility and be your own advocate for your own mental health care. Right. I can't do it for you. You need to do it yourself. And what's interesting, something else that you said too that I want to touch base on real quick, is another episode of PTSD and Beyond, and also mm-hmm. the chat, we talked about ways to help people mm-hmm. find mental health providers. Because what people usually do is they usually look up a person and look at where did they go to school? What does their website say? Does their website say that it'll list off, you know, depression, anxiety, OCD, you know, PTSD, you know, name it. They'll list it. It'll, mm-hmm. Things will be listed out. And, you know, what I've said to people too is that programs are different. So for example, someone can have a master's degree in marriage family therapy that's a trauma specialist because the program they went to had that specialty area for them to study. Just as much as somebody can say, I'm a marriage family therapist or I'm a social worker. No, I never had that educational training, but my practice has always been on this. So people need to be, and what you said was, I started off with this one person and I fired her. When somebody is a self-advocate, that means they are interviewing their providers. And yes. They're saying more than, do they check the box? Oh, they got the degree. Okay, well, what degree do they have? And sometimes I think, and maybe you can shed some light on this, is that people are so vulnerable and so desperate that they want something and they want to find somebody and they are like, can you just help me? It's not that they don't want to be responsible, but they're relying on a system that really isn't, it's not a healthy system to begin with.
Very so true. How, yes.
So what I'm saying is that a listener who's out there saying, wow, this guy actually fired your, and he fired his first therapist. Yes. Yes, you have, you can do that. You can say, you know what? Thanks, but you're not the person for me. I've done that too. Yeah. Because what you, when you click with somebody and somebody, you resonate with somebody, somebody gets you, they're non-judgmental, they accept you, or, you know, for me, it's direct behavior. And being real blunt sometimes and being like swearing, and some people are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you did that. Well, if you're going to be my therapist and if I say the word fuck and it offends you, then that's not going to work because what else is going to happen? Right. To me, that's minor. So what I'm saying to listeners that are out there is that take note to some of the things that we're talking about here and use them. So when you're looking for a provider, practitioner, you know, and then also post on comments if there's other things you want to know. You can say, you know what, like Chris said, I was taking control and what I needed is this. And I decided I'm not going to work with this other person anymore. And I researched and I found a few people, create a checklist, create some questions, ask people, okay, I've got post-traumatic stress or I have symptoms of, share with me your practice. What kind of success stories? What's a treatment plan that you have? What is the typical times that we meet? There are people who have said, well, my therapist wouldn't meet with me through online. Isn't it interesting now with COVID, all the people who said no now say yes?
Now they have to make a living, yes.
They have to make a living, but not, they could have done it before too.
They could have done it before, yes. So they were putting their needs and wants ahead of their patient.
Right.
Which happens a lot in general practitioner medicine, and it happens a lot in behavioral health medicine, and is people, the person that you want to go see and think they're giving you help is only there because they specialize in that laundry list of behavioral health issues, because if you throw a bunch of darts at the wall, eventually you're going to hit a bullseye. Somebody's going to come to you, and whether you specialize in that or not, you're still getting their copay. And that's a cynical way of looking at the behavioral health management plans that some insurances have, but that's what my experience has been.
You know, it's interesting about, now I say that when I say interesting, for folks that are listening, they know that, okay, I'm transitioning to something that just by our conversation is bringing up some other things that I'm seeing in the field. Uh-huh. And I don't know if you've noticed this, Chris, but I've certainly noticed the increase of trauma practitioners. Trauma providers.
Right.
It has increased so much. And I think to myself, I mean, I've seen it everywhere from LinkedIn, from people who are, you know, they do podcasts for marketing. I saw something the other day and I thought, so you're a marketing executive and you have a podcast that's been out there for a decade about teaching people about marketing. And now you're talking about trauma. That's interesting.
Yeah, so, the modern day snake oil salesman.
Right. Unfortunately, this isn't about buying a car and about regretting, you know, having buyer's remorse. This is about people's mental health. This is about people's well-being. This is about people's emotionally and behavioral stability. This is about families. This is about children. This is about extended family. This is about friends. This is about a quality of life. You know, regardless if you believe in karma, we only get one shot at being Deb. I only get one shot at being Deb. You get one shot at being Chris. And so how can we then do things that support, and I don't mean to sound cheesy on this, but I seriously mean it. What can we do to support our overall well-being on a daily basis?
Yeah. I think it for people that are, suffering, I think it has to be a daily affirmation that I want to get better. So after I retired, I started drinking a lot more, as I had said before. And I just, one day I just said, you know what, this is not healthy for me. It's not helping me in any way, shape or form. It's simply empty calories. It's not helping me with my depression. A lot of people think that alcohol will get rid of those negative thoughts in your head. And it doesn't. All it does is it lowers the inhibition. So those negative thoughts have, they become a little bit louder, a little bit sharper in your mind. And I am 905 days sober today. And I have an app on my phone called Nomo. It's a sobriety calendar basically. And it tracks every day. So I opened it up a couple times and just see where my days are. And I looked at it this morning knowing we were going to be talking about it. And I wanted to have the number fresh in my head. So it's, you know, I had to personally, again, just take that step forward and say, I'm done with this. I'm done drinking. It's only increasing the hurtful and harmful thoughts in my head. And that has certainly helped me to focus more on the positive aspects of my behavioral health and the therapy that I do with Dana. Because I would do the EMDR and then go home and drink, and it was really I guess a bad analogy of flushing out the positive steps that we made in therapy and then going home and drinking them away. And it was not you know, one step forward and two steps back, so to speak.
905 days.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yep. Thank you.
Congratulations on that milestone, man. That is freaking awesome.
I am more addicted to coffee now since I stopped drinking, but that's okay.
Oh my gosh. All right. Well, guess what? You've got a coffee buddy drinker for life, because I will never give up my coffee. I told my therapist one time, because she put me on this tablet called Califos. It's a homeopathic for helping anxiety, for those panic attacks, you know, working with the nervous system. And she told me, like, you need to stop drinking coffee. And so I said to her, so for how long? And she said, forever. And I was like, yeah, it's never going to happen.
Unless someone's going to tell me, sorry.
Like a cardiologist is going to tell me, okay, look, Deb, you know what? You really got to give up the coffee. Then I'll consider it. But for this Califos, no. But that is incredible. 905. And the app is called Nomo.
Nomo, yes. It's a sobriety calculator, sobriety app. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And it has a resource page so you can connect with other people through going, you know, help peer counseling and stuff like that. It's a good app. I really enjoy it.
So what other changes have you noticed? So we've got 905, right? We've got a tattoo on our wrist. These are all things that are obvious that you're doing on a daily basis. What you just said here, and I love this because I always take notes so I can put them in the summary, Chris, is that you said, my daily affirmation is, I want to get better. I want to get better. So how do we ignore the haters, right? And the doubters, because there's always people. I shared something with someone the other day and it was like, okay, crickets. And I thought, you know what? I'm proud of myself. You know, that's what matters the most. And it's like, okay, you know, and this was just in passing conversation. It wasn't somebody who's in what I would say my immediate family, but sometimes we do latch on to what haters and doubters say. I mean, if I paid attention to some stuff that's on social media, and I'll be honest too, and I know that folks that know me, when I see someone bullying someone online, there was something that happened a few months ago, and I DM someone and said, are you all right? You know, I know the person you're talking about. I don't know them personally. I think you should block them. And I actually unfollowed too. I was like, yeah, this isn't all right. So how do we ignore those haters and doubters? And then how do we get back to, I love this daily affirmation of, I want to get better.
I think that you hit on a really good point there, is that you can just scroll right past these people. You don't have to comment. And I think people that they see something online that they think is negative, maybe an attack towards them, and they want to defend themselves. And I understand that, but I think what people need to understand is these people are saying the negative thing to you because that's exactly the response they want. They feed off of that, and they know that if you react in a certain way, that they got to you, they pushed your button, and they will just keep pushing that button. So you don't, my thing is with, on Twitter, if I see stuff, that I just don't agree with, I just keep scrolling. You know, I don't need to get into these, keyboard wars with people who I don't know me and clearly don't care about me. So just either block it or just keep scrolling. You know, you will be a better person knowing that you didn't respond to them, and you can think, boy, they're going to be mad that I just kept right on going. And just, it's not worth your time, effort, and energy, because what'll happen is you'll begin to question, is what that person said about me, is that right? Maybe he's right. Maybe she's right. Those people don't know you. Don't give them the time of day, and just say that, you know, that has to be part of your daily routine of, I'm going to worry about Chris today. I'm going to worry about Deb. I'm not worrying about anybody else but me. I'm the only one that matters right now, because what is going on in my brain, no one else can hear it. No one else sees it. It's just me. I have to be the one to take control of it.
Right. That is so true. No one else can hear it. No one else can see it. People can relate to it. When we talk about peer advocates, and then also, you know, reaching out to folks with lived experiences and saying, hey, what did you do? People that come to PTSD and Beyond to listen to our podcast and listen to our guests. And that's why it's so important when, you know, people will say, hey, I want to be on here, or where I'm looking for people. It's like, you know what? Yep. That is what listeners are asking to listen to and to hear. Because there's so much information out there. And the other thing is, there's so many people who like to hide, and their only intent is to do harm. And guys, and when I say guys, I mean men and women that are listening, people of transgender, gender neutral. There are, unfortunately, people right now that are grabbing onto all of the traumatic events that are happening in our world today. And instead of being uplifting supporters and kind and compassionate, unfortunately, these people, I'm going to say they seek pleasure out of invoking pain and hurt.
Yes.
And
yes.
And regardless of the title, this is what another key thing that I keep repeating to people. People are people regardless of the title or position. It doesn't matter if somebody is a doctor. They're a person. Doesn't mean that they're a good person. So again, who you surround yourself with, who are you listening to, what are you watching, all of that affects our mood, our emotions, our mindsets, what we think about ourselves, how our day is going to be. And sometimes we're just not as resilient as we'd like to be, because every day looks different. And some moments look different. So go to Chris's website. I'm going to have all his information on the summary page. You can go ahead and read more about him, connect with him about his workshops, his training, some of the things that he's doing in Arizona, and also, you know, virtually, as well as, of course, the stuff that we're doing on PTSD and Beyond on Monday, our chat at 8:00 Eastern Standard Time, as well as every Friday we come out with a podcast. And the last couple of weeks, I know people have been very gracious as I've been just, you know, trying to shape and get some sort of foundation with some things that have happened in our family. And what's beautiful about all this, though, is that when we have people around us that can say, our details might be different, but I understand and I get it, or our details are very similar, and you know what? What can I do to help? How can I be there? What can we do to make sure that we are heard, we are enough, and that we're doing our best on a daily basis. Because people who are what I always say all in and are committed, they've made the decision, they've made the commitment, it's part of their everyday life, do think about this every day. I want to be better. Mm-hmm. I want to get better, and I'm going to continue to get better, and I'm going to continue to pave that path, as well as so other people then can say, you know what, not alone. There are other people here who understand what I'm thinking and I'm feeling and I'm going through. At the end of the day, though, it takes the person to make that decision and be their own advocate and be mm-hmm. their own person to make those decisions and to take that daily action.
Yeah. Yeah. The daily affirmations are incredibly important. And tomorrow being the anniversary of 9/11, one thing that I have done is I haven't watched any television about 9/11 in probably 10 or 12 years, just because I know that it was adversely affecting me. So if people are, you're a survivor of trauma and you know that these types of anniversaries are coming up, just, you know, separate yourself from it. One thing that I did want to mention, if you don't mind, is one of the interesting things that I found out with my body basically was I was taking Zoloft and we had a guest speaker come into the group therapy out here one day, and a psychiatrist by the name of Jeff, and he was talking about DNA and how you should get a DNA test to see if the medications that you're taking actually work. So I did, and I found that my liver did not metabolize the ingredients of Zoloft. So I was not getting the help that I needed. I had like the placebo effect. Oh, I'm taking an antidepressant, so I'll be a little bit, but I just personally did not feel that I was as good as I should have been while taking that medicine. And it was because my body wasn't metabolizing it. So I showed the results to my doctor, and she was even pretty fascinated by it. And then we switched to Effexor, and I've been taking that for about a year and a half, and it's markedly different for me. So if your health insurance will cover it, it's a quick little swab on the inside of your cheek, and it'll tell you which medications you should be taking and you shouldn't be taking.
That's really interesting. Again, because there are just in recent lived experience on this one, the way that practices are done here in the United States are completely different from the other parts of the country, such as the United Kingdom. And right. What's interesting is that there are doctors who will say, no, our first line of defense is Zoloft, before they'll even consider doing something else. And then the long list of side effects, like, you know, this hyperness and twitching just erratic behavior, aggressiveness, you know, and unless somebody is actually watching and knows the person who's on it, or a person is old enough, you know, meaning that they're consciously mature enough to say, hey, you know what, this isn't quite right. I'm not really mm-hmm. feeling so hot. Mm-hmm. It takes, you know, and they're more of try and see, where if we can do a test that's effective to show that, hey, you know what, these are medications that are absorbed because of my DNA. I think that's where technology becomes very useful and beneficial. Yes. And helpful, as opposed Yes. to, well, we're just going to look and wait and see. Because sometimes, to be frank, we don't really have the time to wait and see. We really don't True. Have, because there can be several months before something is quote unquote stable in the body. Correct. And yet how much havoc is going to be there? And what's the collateral damage behind us, right? Or the person right. that we're trying to get the help for. So always, it's a really good point to bring up that if a listener is out there and they're taking medication and you still are questioning and wondering, perhaps you can contact your provider and say that you want to have this test taken. I mean, it's an idea of an example of something that somebody else has done. So real quick here, last few things to touch on. What are three things, Chris, that you'd like listeners to have takeaways from? If you could just, you know, let's wrap it up here on what are like three things that you're like saying, you know what, man, I really wish people could just get this or know this or take this away and have it as a nugget to contemplate on?
I would definitely say you're not alone. There are millions of us out there who are struggling every day with numerous different things. And there are a lot of avenues out there to help. I know firsthand it's uncomfortable talking about this. It took me years to even talk about any of this. I have an ex-wife who did not know that I was a survivor of suicide. I just was not comfortable talking about it, the stigma behind it. Not comfortable talking about my own behavior or health. And there are a lot of people out there who don't want to talk about it. And you have to be, the second point, I guess, would be you have to be your own patient advocate. Don't take your doctor, your therapist, your psychiatrist's word for it. Do research and make sure that you are doing the best that you can do for you. And the third one would be that EMDR works. As much as I hate it, it is incredibly helpful and challenging for me and to me. But I know that I don't like how I feel when I leave the session in the next couple of days. But you know, 2 or 3 days later, I do see that the light at the end of the tunnel was not a train coming at me. It was clarity coming into my head, saying, "Okay, we can deal with this in a positive way, and we can move past it." So that what EMDR does is you're not going to forget the memory. It's not that little zappy thing that they had in Men in Black that it makes you forget your entire memory. The memory will still be there. The memory just will not control you physically, emotionally, and behavioral health wise. You will be able to think about that event in your life and say, "Okay, that happened," and move forward and not be able, not have it control you. So probably 5 or 6 years ago, as close as 5 or 6 years ago, I wasn't even able to talk about my father's suicide without crying and becoming very, very emotional. And now it's I can talk about it as a helpful way, just like I can sit here and talk about my favorite Starbucks coffee. So it doesn't control me anymore, but it is still there. I'll never forget about it, but it will not control me the way that it used to. And that is all because of Dana and EMDR.
And it's all because of the commitment and decision and work that you've done for yourself, Chris.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not that's very true. I know. And Dana would say the exact same thing. I'm not one to give myself credit, I guess, about stuff like that, but yes, it is. You have to be, I am trying to be a better advocate for myself as much as I'm telling others to be their own advocate.
Isn't it? And you know what else is interesting too is that I have found, and I'm the same way, is that when people will talk to me and say, "I cannot believe that you did that." Right. How were you able to go back there? How were you able to confront your abuser? How the hell did you do that? Right? And I just think, well, because it's part of it. It's part of the commitment. It's part of what, and for me, what I consider doing the work, right?
Yes.
And then people will say, "Oh my gosh." And I think, no, right? Nah. And we're so humble. And why I say that is that people who really are doing the work every day and others reach out, as soon as you give us a compliment, just like yourself, you're like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to give this person the recognition because they were there. They were instrumental in my care and my behavioral health recovery. And this, you know, technique that I used." And then ultimately though, it's you who did the work,
yes,
right? We can bring the horse to the water, but we can't make the horse drink the water.
Correct.
And yet we're so humble on it. And that's really what makes you special, Chris. That's what makes you, you. That's what makes people gravitate toward you. That's what makes people want to hear your story. That's what you bring hope to other people. You, this whole thing right now, our conversation for listeners and myself included, hearing everything that you're saying says, you know what? It might be shit right now. And you know what? It can look different the next moment and it can look different tomorrow. And these are some things that I can do. These are some places that I can go. And here's a person with lived experience that gives me hope to know, you know what? I can too. Folks,
Those are very, very true. Thank you, Deb. Thank you very much for that.
I want to give again a heartfelt shout out to Chris Diver for being here today. And again, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and just to see what you're doing. And tomorrow, I know that it's a big anniversary for everybody. And again, a key takeaway right now, folks, is that if people have any adverse effects to anything, remember, it's okay to say, you know what, I'm going to separate myself from that. And maybe go back and listen to another of episode of PTSD and Beyond, or go ahead and take a look at our chat on Twitter using the hashtag PTSD and Beyond. Guys, this is Dr. Devlin with PTSD and Beyond and our gracious guest, Chris Diver. You guys make it a great week, and we'll see each other next time.
Thank you, Deb.
Thanks so much, Chris.